At the end of the day, everybody loses. If I convince a candidate to come here and they shouldn't, or a candidate convinces me to hire them and I shouldn't, right? Like, everybody's gonna lose. The honeymoon's gonna wear off. You know, it's gonna hurt the team that they're on.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Raman Ori. Raman is the president of SEP, or Software Engineering Professionals. He builds software teams that help his clients build exceptional software and systems. SEP is different from many software development shops because their clients work directly with the software engineers themselves. This adds tons of value for the client, but also makes every new hire more risky. Every software engineer he brings on will be responsible for representing the SEP name to a client. So Raman needs to avoid making the wrong hire at all costs. Furthermore, the expectation he sets with his team is to help their clients level up their software practices. That means the risk of potentially hiring the wrong person is extra high. He needs someone technically sound with excellent communication and collaboration skills, and every wrong hire could deal serious damage to his team's reputation. This has led his team to adopt extremely thorough, risk-averse hiring practices that make it extremely hard to make the wrong hire. In this episode, we'll explore those hiring practices and uncover how you can leverage those tactics in your organization. There's great value in this conversation, so let's get to it. Here is Raman Ori. Raman, what is the most important inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
This one's pretty juicy, especially for early in the interview. So 2 years in to my career at SEP. So I started SEP fresh out of school. And about 2 years in, there was a major management changeover, sort of the one and only in SEP's 30 years. And in that moment, I had been working mostly with the outgoing folks. And I actually resigned from the company and I accepted another position. And so I was in this weird transition of starting to understand what my new job would be and winding up things at SEP. And I realized that I had made a really terrible mistake. And it was one of those things, like, until I was at least had one foot outside looking back in, I couldn't see what I was giving up. And I incredibly lucky, I kind of went back, I asked for some forgiveness on that and was accepted. And 23 years later, here we are.
Wow. I didn't realize you had actually resigned. So what did you see that you were missing? What did you look back and saw, like, I don't want to leave this?
It was, this is going to sound harsh, but it was a level of integrity. The other place, which will remain nameless, I literally had been there for an hour one day when someone said to me, who does SEP work for? Who can, you know, what are the names? Can you get phone numbers? Can we call? And I thought, like, wow, I just couldn't imagine something like that happening. That seemed completely unethical, immoral to me, you know, to do that. And that it wasn't even a, like, let's get warmed up and get to know each other. It was just right off the bat. Let's go. What do you got for me? And realizing that in my 2 years at SEP, I had never seen anything remotely like that. Like, oh, geez, what am I doing? It was you know, instantly dropped into a pool of cold water. Oh yeah, this is what the world is like. Don't be an idiot.
That's good advice. I think that can be the title of our conversation.
Don't be an idiot. Thanks.
When did you start leading software teams? Can you kind of walk us through how that happened?
I was a few years in here at SEP. This is after that fateful moment. I was working on a solo project, an automotive service tool, and the customer had some big plans coming up and they needed us to scale up. And I think at the time we were pretty full. And so in terms of work that we had, and so there weren't other people to help me right off. And the only people who had any bandwidth were actually the managers and owners of the company. So my first time leading a team was with part-time from the founders and owners of the company, which is a little intimidating. I'm not going to say I gave too much tough performance feedback on that one as a first-time software lead, but yeah, I was able to pull that team together with their spare time and help the customer get there.
Did you feel right before that that being a team leader was something you were always interested in doing, or was it more of a reluctant change for you?
While I don't love attention or being the focal point, I have always felt pretty comfortable jumping in Not because I think I have all the answers, but just more of a sense of responsibility. There's things to do. Let's go do them. If nobody else has stepped in, I'll step in. That's fine. You know. So I had almost always stepped into leadership roles in other organizations I was in college and high school. So it was relatively natural.
And did it feel, was there any big difference between leading that technical team the first time versus your past leadership experiences?
Surprisingly, people were more willing to listen to me in that context than they were, say, like as an officer of my fraternity. People didn't want to, you know, nobody wanted to listen. In the high school club, it's hard to get people motivated. I don't know. I guess it was something about the workplace, even though they were all, you know, far more experienced than me. They could recognize what we need to get a job done, and that's my role. So they were actually super helpful and cooperative. That was the biggest difference with first leadership there.
That's a pretty solid solid difference. I think mostly the feedback is the other direction. It's hard to get people to listen to you. So it's a special environment. How do you think about getting better?
I think about it constantly. And I think about it in terms of all aspects of life. So not I'm just going to get better at work or I'm just going to get better in my personal life. I find too much crossover. So maybe the chief mechanism is just putting myself in the beginner's mindset. You've asked before, you know, what have you done for the first time lately? I find that to be an unbelievable tool for just shaking myself out of preconceived notions and ruts that I've gotten into. So a lot of times lately for me, that's been fitness, but other times it could be a programming thing like, hey, machine learning sounds cool. I'm going to go take a class or quantum computing. I have no practical use for this, but I want to know how it works. So let's go and then jump in and see what happens.
Do you think that that lack of separation between personal and professional betterment has an impact on how fast you get better in a professional context? Or do you think they're kind of separate pieces?
No, I think they're completely related. You know, when you do that thing for the first time, there's a lot of failure. And when you're sort of in your groove at work, there's not a lot of failure typically. And it's easy to get risk averse. It's easy to get stuck in your ways. So I find the pattern repeats perfectly across all of these boundaries are nonsense anyway, right? That work and personal life, like it's not like you shut off that whole part of your life anyway when you show up to work or when you go home. So I don't know. I find the patterns repeat. One other tool I found useful is to do some scope limiting. So I will just keep, I have a Trello backlog of crazy things that I don't know how to do that I want to do or I want to get better or experiments I want to try. But I know if I try to start five of them, that's not going to go well, right? You know, things are going to get washed out. So try to keep it to just one or two things at a time and then periodically go back to that list and see if it's time to add a new one.
So you got a work in progress limit for your new things.
Yes.
And what are some of the, can you share what's on that list right now?
Stuff I haven't done yet or stuff I am in the process of?
What are you in the process of?
So in the process of learning how to road cycle, so like endurance cycling on the road, on a bike, I literally had not ridden a bike as an adult. I'm 47 years old. So I got on a bike on the street this year with some good coaching. Thanks, Matt. Don't try this on your own. Spent all summer getting out and learning how to do it.
Who are SCP's customers and how do you help them make progress in their lives?
So they're generally mid to large size companies. They are either software companies or they're tech enabled. So they have a physical product like a tractor or automobile, a medical device, or it could be a financial product. But software is some crucial element of that thing. And these days, that I pretty much described every business. Every business is a tech business now. But software is some key part of that. We are then either their software development department or part of their software development department. Ostensibly, they're hiring us to make the donuts, right? Go build this product with me or for me. But kind of like with medicine, there's some off-label uses that we're finding more and more are as important to our customers, which is just generally helping them level up a little bit. And not that our customers aren't very good at it. That's not what I'm saying. But as a small company doing this thing, by definition, we better be really good at it or we don't exist. And so in a lot of cases, we may have more modern practices or we may have exposure to things that our customers haven't seen yet. And we can help their teams learn how to do that alongside getting the work done.
Tell me a bit about SCP's engineering team, where it is right now, what growth looks like, maybe where it was a year ago, where it is now, and where it's going to be in a year.
Sure. So from a composition size, so there's 135 people in the company, about 115 of them are in service delivery, meaning they're providing the value to the customers. They are leads and managers and analysts, product folks, UX folks, and engineers. And the engineers probably make up about 100 of them. our roots are very engineering focused, and we've added UX and product skills over time. In terms of the sort of capabilities and where we work, I mentioned Agile before. We're big believers in lean and Agile techniques, and in general, we're process nerds. So we're constantly obsessing about how can we get better. So in terms of, let's say, how we do the work, today, a lot of times it looks scrummish, but we're constantly tweaking and evolving, and teams have a lot of autonomy to go figure that out. You know, how do we make this work with the other teams that are involved? How do we make this work with the regulatory aspects that this customer may have or their own SOPs? And then tweaking that iteration after iteration, get better all the time, right? In terms of the what we work on, we work across a huge range of industries, a medical device, aerospace, automotive, ag, finance, on and on, education. Technology-wise, we're similarly schizophrenic. Mobile, desktop, web, embedded, and now increasingly cloud native. So you talked about, you know, where's the progression? I would say the last several years, the big progression has been not just building a web application that could live in the cloud, but designing for that from the get-go. And how do we take advantage of the seemingly overwhelming and constant flow of new features on Azure and AWS and use that to accelerate product development for our customers?
Gotcha. So not just bolting on the cloud as an afterthought, but designing with that from the start.
Yeah, and we have several engagements where we're sort of in the midst of big builds based on, you know, we're going to build out a digital business to go with our physical business, and how do we use these services to do that? And in other cases, we are sort of cleaning up from past lift and shift. So, you know, we build a thing, then we shifted it to the cloud, and then holy crap, this bill is unbelievably expensive and our systems are inefficient. Now let's go back and take advantage of what is natively available to us. And so we have several engagements like that too. The other place we're seeing a lot of growth and change is DevOps. So it was this buzzwordy thing. I think it was a thing. I don't know. Is this a part of our deal? And today it's pretty deeply woven in everything that we're doing, or every project we're doing.
What has been the biggest challenge you face? You're 100 engineers now. You presumably weren't when you started long ago and resigned. What has been the biggest growth challenge you face as you scaled up the organization?
In a sense, I might say it's right now. We're actually in the midst of it. So it may not be an awesome story because I can't tell you how it works out. But so a little bit of context. As a professional services firm, if you are optimizing for revenue, then I want every single person to be billable every minute that they're at work, right? But that's not practical. There are things that need to happen, sales work, marketing, HR, coaching and mentoring, PD, support, like there's all these other things that have to happen. And we're in a moment where I would say that the defined leadership roles are few, and the leadership needs and the available leaders are many. And so those leaders are overwhelmed with a million initiatives and a million ways they want to make the place better. And I have lots of other people who are ready to lead and ready to do stuff. And we're in a sort of a transitionary moment where we figure out, like, this sounds kind of boring when I say it this way, but like, what does the org chart look like? How should we do it? What are the right roles that this is a meaningful role to take somebody out of service delivery and put them into, or let them grow into, where they're going to have real impact? So I'd say we're actually right in the middle of that. And in my career, this is probably the biggest challenge I've seen, how to do this well.
Earlier, you said you were looking to grow your company by 15 or so engineers, 6-7% in the next year. With all that hiring, could you walk us through what the hiring process looks like from the candidate's perspective?
Sure. So they're typically going to come to us one or two vectors. We'll talk about the fresh out of college vector first. So about 2/3 of our technical hires are fresh out of college. And so typically they're going to have heard about us from past intern, from an on-campus event, from a job posting in their campus recruiting system, something like that. We try to participate in on-campus groups like Society for Women Engineers, or come talk to a class about professional techniques, just, you know, trying to stay connected. So they're gonna know about us. We're gonna come on campus and we're gonna do a first interview, which is typically 45 minutes. And I don't know that ours is any different or more magical than anybody else's. We're gonna ask a lot of behavior questions. We're gonna poke and prod at what they really want to see if there's a potential fit, and frankly share a little bit to make sure that if they want to self-select out, they can early.
And a behavior question, that's like a tell me about a time type question.
Yeah, so tell me a hook for juniors out there. So we will often ask something like, tell me about a project that went really well, something you're really proud of. And then we'll come back with a counterpunch, like tell me about a project that went bad. And in fact, the bigger the disaster, the better for the purposes of our interview, right? So yeah, we'll typically ask questions like that and see if we have a potential fit. Out of that group, some will get invited for an on-site interview. And that's usually a full day affair. They're going to get a tour. They're going to get, which, you know, it's a tour. It's cubes and computers. It's not that exciting, but it is a chance to tell stories. And so we'll introduce them to people on teams and say, hey, Wes, why don't you tell Bob here about what you're working on? Which is a side benefit for us too, right? People get a little practice talking about what they're doing. But, you know, as much as possible, put the picture to the words. We're going to do some technical screening. So we're going to see what they've got, not in terms of a syntax quiz or can they, you know, cite everything from the Gang of Four book, but instead, can they solve problems? Can they understand? Can they communicate? Things like that. And then we're going to give them as much chance as possible to see who we really are, because we would really, really, really like them to not come here unless this is where they want to be. After that, we make a decision.
So you said that, you know, we don't want them to come here if they're not. You have an opt-in. And your initial, or an opt out in your initial interview, why do you emphasize that?
At the end of the day, everybody loses. If I convince a candidate to come here and they shouldn't, or a candidate convinces me to hire them and I shouldn't, right? Like everybody's going to lose. The honeymoon's going to wear off, and you know it's going to hurt the team that they're on. It's going to hurt them personally. It's going to potentially hurt a client that we're working with. Like everybody loses. So I don't really even understand how we've arrived kind of as a recruiting industry at this game. Like I'm going to put on this big veneer and this mask, and I'm going to try and trick you into hiring me, or I'm going to tell you our company's perfect and not expose anything that might not be a fit for you. Like why are we doing this? This is nuts, you know? And in fact, we even invite that. Now I don't think I've ever had a candidate take me up on this, but when they come for the on-site, I'll tell them at the beginning of the day, like at any moment today, you're walking around and you think, this is not for me. This is not what I want. Just tell me. No one will be offended. I'll be happy to get my day back. A win for us is just making a good decision, not convincing you to come here. So we're big on that.
So it sounds like avoiding mishires is a big focus for your process. Would you say that's the prime directive is not making mishire?
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. So we are extremely cautious and risk averse in hiring. When we make a hire, we're pretty sure. We're pretty sure. And that's not to say we don't end up being wrong, but we almost certainly turn away some good candidates who would have worked out, but we just weren't sure. We weren't confident enough. You know, it's kind of peering behind the curtain a little bit. Like everybody who takes part in an interview, they have to say in their evaluation, yes, this person meets these criteria. And if there's anything that is not a yes, then it is a no. We will decline that candidate. If any person involved in the interview says they're not a fit on this criteria. So very, very risk averse.
Yeah, let's peek behind that curtain. So that the candidate's process is that 45-minute interview, then the on-site. What is, from your perspective, how do the interviewers make those decisions and communicate?
So we do all our interviews together. So I know some people interview where you as the candidate would spend some time with person A, then person B, then person C, and each would ask their own questions and then fill out the form. We actually spend the day together. So it just we feel like that gives a better experience. You don't have to repeat the same story 7 times and you know, sick of hearing yourself talk. They're really gonna look at 3 criteria. They're gonna And I stole 2 of these explicitly from Joel Spolsky's great little recruiting book and blog, SMART and Get Things Done, if you've ever seen that. So SMART meaning they're capable of doing the work. And some of the words on our form we would like to change. Like, I'm not saying people we don't hire aren't smart. That's not what we're saying. it's a, you know, sort of a blanket name for a criteria. Do we think they can do the work? Can they learn fast? Can they solve problems? Second is get things done. So do they deliver? Are they the kind of person who always finds a way to get there? Or are they the kind of person who always finds a reason they can't get there? And, you know, if you've worked at it for any amount of time, you've met folks on either side of that, right? So that, by the way, is the hardest thing for us to judge in an interview. And then third is fit. And this is the word we have the most discomfort with. We all know what it means internally, but there is sort of a fear as we get bigger and as, you know, new people come in that fit might be taken to mean looks like us, sounds like us, has the same background as me, right? And that's not what we mean. What we mean is aligned on values and principles. In other words, the things that we hold dear are things that are compatible with them. So sometimes you hear a culture ad, we love that. But I don't want to lose the aligned on values. So those are the things that they're trying to figure out that day.
As you're, you said that as you grow, you're kind of worried more about that fit definition, kind of switching into homogeneity. I don't know how to say that word. How do you plan to, what ideas do you have to kind of fight against that?
First, we're going to redo the form. So we're actually looking at applicant tracking system. We have some custom built stuff because, of course, a bunch of engineers, we would go make this thing instead of just buying it. I think we're ready to stop maintaining our own system, though, and buy something. When we do, we'll rebuild these forms. So first, we'll get rid of that word, and we'll say more explicitly what we mean. Overall, it has been a constant theme of our recruiting team over the last several years to think more about diversity. And we, you know, physical diversity is a proxy, right? What you really want is creative thinking, people coming from different backgrounds, different perspectives, different ways of being. So race and gender and skin, these are proxies, but they're the best proxies I have available. So we've been working on that, and our team has done a pretty good job of embracing that. So at the moment, I don't have to throw a lot on this fire. They're already going there. I just want to make sure we lay groundwork for the future that these tools don't lead us into trouble later.
I heard that you have some problems with how some folks use personality profiles in hiring. What's the right way to think of personality profiles in hiring?
My little byline on this has always been, you should use a personality test to know why you're a jerk, not why somebody else is a jerk. Being serious for a minute, though, I see both extremes out there, right? You see the folks who say, this is exactly the makeup that is necessary to do this job, and so I'm going to find some personality and demeanor testing that figures out if this person has those characteristics, and if they do, I'll hire them. If it doesn't, I won't. And that scares me to death, because I think about how accurate, how precise are these instruments? How well do I really know what I need? And even if those criteria were true today, what about a year from now? Because, you know, business changes, everything changes, roles change. So I'm really, really scared of that. And I'm also cognizant of, you know, if somebody's going through an interview process, you're not, as much as I just was saying, you know, you try to be yourself, there's a lot of pressure in that moment. I mean, what if you're, you know, you really need to get that next job? You know, are you really being yourself? And what's going to come through on that test? You're going to say what you need to say, right? Then the other end of the spectrum, the folks who say, all personality testing is nonsense. It's just, it's astrology. I think maybe the science is a little fuzzy, but I think there's a lot of value just as a tool for self-reflection. So if I take this test, what does it tell me about me? What does it tell me that I don't want to hear? And, you know, take that test to someone, like say a spouse or a loved one. And they'll tell you the things that are true there that you really didn't want to believe, right? You know, that's a great test. So I think there's value. I just don't like them in the hiring context.
Who's the best engineer you've worked with that had the worst on paper resume?
So there is a guy here I've worked with for 22 years. He went to a school that I only know the name of because they were in the NCAA tournament one year and it had a funny name. I think he spent half of his college career in music or sound production, which is a very technical field, but obviously really different from computer science. Like today, I think if I got that resume, there's a really good chance that I wouldn't interview this candidate. And it's turned out to be one of the five smartest people I've ever met and most productive, get things done, find a way kind of people.
Audio engineer. That's a new one for me. This show is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help software teams hit ambitious hiring goals. We do that by improving the fuzziest step in the hiring process, candidate screening. By giving every candidate a fair chance to show what they can do, our customers find more great candidates and they back their decisions with evidence to remove bias. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your development team, check us out at woventeams.com. Okay, great. We're going to close with some rapid fire questions. They're supposed to be quick hit, short answers. Feel free to take your time to think. We'll shorten it up. You ready?
Yep.
Interviewing for jobs is stressful, it's not natural, and we all make mistakes. What's the biggest goof you've ever made while being interviewed?
Not being myself. So the very first plane trip I ever had, I tried to fit in with the crowd. So they did a big drinking thing, you know, they took everybody out on the town, and I tried to be one of them instead of just being myself. And predictably, I didn't do very well not being myself.
Walk me through the interview that had the most lasting positive impact on your impression of a candidate.
You're going to think I'm pandering. Yours, Wes Winham. I interviewed you coming out of college. Here, I'll prove it. So, and for the listeners, I didn't manage to get Wes, but it stuck, right? So how long ago did you graduate?
2007.
Yeah, okay, so 11 years. You, in that interview, talked about, this was an on-campus interview, the first interview like we talked before, you talked about doing continuous integration and continuous deployment on a system that was doing some kind of sort of e-commerce around a game currency, right?
That's
Am I
it,
remembering
yeah.
right?
That's
that
right.
was the project. I knew very few professionals who were talking about CI and CD in that moment. And just that you were experimenting with that on a academic project, or heck, it might even have been a personal project for all I know. Absolutely blew me away.
Well, I will give you your payment for saying that later. Thank you. What does a 6-star culture edition look like?
So right off the bat, there's a getting involved piece. But you would expect that of any candidate. But I would say within a relatively short period of time, somebody who starts to both champion and push. So I want them to question, like, well, I thought we were about this, and this feels completely contrary to that. Please tell me about that, right? That to me is a 6-star culture addition, because that's somebody who's going to help us get better.
What's an interesting problem your team will be working towards in the next year? Now, there's a bunch of problems across a bunch of industry. What's one that you're especially excited about?
Once upon a time, we were all engineers here, and UX wasn't a thing to us. That was a thing, you know, somebody else can make this look pretty. We're doing this very hard engineering thing. About 10 to 12 years ago, you know, it sort of hit the entire industry upside the head. Like, UX is important. Not just making it pretty, but making it intuitive, making it fit the user's context. We make things that might get used on the deck of a carrier. So a 20-year-old Navy tech trying to use handheld our software as jets are taking off next to his head. That has impact on how you build something, right? So over the last 10 to 12 years, we've integrated UX into how we work, but we're still getting there. The next big piece for us is product thinking. And so how do we integrate that? And it's not a case of we're going to take over product management for customers. Yes, we will talk to your customers. We'll figure out what you should make. That inherently belongs to our customers. But the translation of that and the bringing new techniques and helping them use our engineering capabilities to test those things quickly and make great decisions, I feel like is absolutely going to be necessary to be fit for the market at some near point in the future. Today, I think I have to convince customers to let us help them with this. I think at some point it will be a given in the way that UX is a given today.
What advice do you have for an engineer looking to get hired on one of your teams?
First and foremost, be yourself. Just be yourself. You put the veneer on, we might not figure out who you really are, but we will know that you had the veneer up and we won't take the risk, right? You either are a potential fit in terms of values and talent and what you're looking for, or you're not, and it's okay, let's just figure it out. So you gotta be yourself, otherwise we can't figure it out.
What makes SEP uniquely great to work with?
I haven't worked anywhere else other than for about 5 minutes, as we talked about earlier. However, I get exposed to a lot of companies through work, through friends, and what I see a lot of is just a lot of things that drain from people's natural desire to do good work. So I think fundamentally, people want to go do good work. They want to do stuff they're proud of. They want to do a good job. They want to work with other people who want to do a good job, and they'd like that thing to have meaningful impact. And if you can create that scenario for people, they'll be pretty happy, really. you know, if they're in their domain. And so what I think we do very well here is that we focus on that. So when we hire an engineer, I want them to come here, or a designer or a project manager, I want them to do great work. I want them to be a great teammate. I want them to get better. And if they will focus on those things, everything else will work itself out. And so removing all of those, all that friction on doing great work and being a great teammate, I think we do really well.
Remen, thanks so much for being on our show today.
Thanks, Wes. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Remen for sitting down with me to talk about his journey. Here are my top takeaways from our conversation. The most notable aspect of my conversation with Remen was how deliberate his team is in every hiring decision they make. His primary motivation during the hiring process is to avoid a mishire, and he has engineered his entire hiring process to help him accomplish that goal. This means, of course, more robust screening, but it also means more intentional screening. And I think that's a great vision of where hiring will be in 10 years. Today, many organizations understand that they need to do more screening, but the levels of screening don't have disparate goals. The resume is used to qualify experience, which leads to a phone interview where you ask questions about their experience, which leads to an in-person interview with a resume in hand where you ask about their experience. Experience matters, but it's not the most important thing. It doesn't deserve three separate layers of screening. Instead, Remen takes a different tact. His interview process is designed to test different things at different levels. It mirrors the complementary nature of unit tests, integration tests, and acceptance tests. Resume screening eliminates anyone who is obviously unqualified. A woven scenario eliminates anyone who either doesn't have the technical prowess or collaboration skills to do the job effectively. When he interviews a candidate, he has questions suggested to him by the woven team based on the candidate's performance on the scenario, allowing them to dive deeper on their skill set. That means that in the on-site interview, which costs the most time, Remen is confident that they're spending time with the candidates most likely to be a good fit. Personally, I'm incredibly excited to watch Remen's team grow through this methodology, and I hope that your team can learn something from it too. Here are a few of the key lessons I picked up from Remen today. Deliberate hiring is the key to long-term growth. SEP has been in the game since 1988, and they're still growing 30 years later. That's a level of long-term success that most software leaders can only dream of, but it wasn't magic. It was patience. The SEP team is incredibly deliberate and patient with their hiring process. They actively give candidates an opt-out during the office tour to emphasize the importance of fit on both sides. Remen routinely says, "If at any point today you think that this isn't for you, just tell me. No one will be offended, and I'll be happy to get my day back." Personality tests are easy to misuse. Remen has mixed feelings about personality tests. They're polarizing in the development space. Some people love them and others hate them. Remen thinks the truth is more nuanced. In his view, personality tests can be valuable, but you have to take those results with a grain of salt and not be overly reliant on them. They're not predictive of job performance because there's no one right personality for any job. At the end of the day, Remen presents sage advice when he says, "You should use personality tests to figure out why you're a jerk, not why someone else is a jerk." Deliberate candidate screening can go a long way to avoiding mishires. Candidate screening is really hard. Typically, in a fast-growth organization, you need to get talented engineers in the door as quickly as possible, so you're not exactly taking your time to develop the most robust screening process. Based on his experience building his team, however, Remen would recommend a far more robust and deliberate screening process, where each stage teaches you something different from the last. A win for us is making a good decision, not just getting you to come here. I'm excited to learn along this journey with you, and I'm always looking for your feedback about how to make the show better. If you have anyone you think I should interview, tweet me at Wes Winham or at woven_teams, and I'll reach out. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing, and I'll see you next Monday.